You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Our series that we've been doing is Jesus One-on-One, where we're basically just surveying through the Gospels instances where Jesus has one-on-one interactions with other individuals. And they're cool because they're different than some of his public teaching or some of the other, you know, discourses that he goes on. They're very personal. That's the whole point, right? They're relational. And it's one of the things that I love about the Word is that sometimes the Word is very powerful and in your face. Sometimes the Word is like, here is a command for you to wrestle with. And then other times, God's Word kind of sneaks up on you, you know, where you're not... You didn't see it coming, but he kind of surprises you in personal interactions. And I think that we get a lot of those, and certainly this one today fits that. We're going to be in Mark chapter 5, and with each of these, we're trying to ask three questions. We're trying to ask, what does this passage teach us about God or Jesus? Because Jesus is usually revealing something about himself or about the Father in these passages. So what does it teach us about God? What does it teach us about ourselves? Because often he's also revealing something about the human condition, or maybe even about you personally that we see as he interacts with fallen people. And then finally, what does it tell us about salvation? Because Jesus is on a mission to rescue the world. So what does it teach us about God? What does it teach us about ourselves? And what does it teach us about salvation? Those are the three questions that we're going to ask. So let's jump in. Matthew 5, verse 21 says, when Jesus had crossed over again in the boat to the other side, a large crowd gathered around him, and so he stayed by the seashore. So this is the Sea of Galilee. He's been in sort of a Gentile area, and now he's crossing over, probably over to Capernaum on the north side. This is Jesus's neck of the woods that he's back in. And it says that a giant crowd or a large crowd gathers around him. Because at this point in his ministry, Jesus is well known and he's very popular among people. He's got a reputation as this dynamite teacher. He's got a reputation as a miracle worker. And so wherever he goes, people are accumulating around him. They want to hear from him. They love him. And they love him almost as much as the religious authorities hate him. Because he's this polarizing figure, right? Where some are very attracted to him in a certain way. Some are drawn to him. And others are repulsed by him, specifically the people who kind of have the religious traditional power base that Jesus has really been subverting and upending. And so that's important because verse 22 says, one of the synagogue officials named Jairus came up. Uh-oh. Here's a familiar pattern. Is Jesus is out there, he's doing a miracle, he's teaching or something, and one of these religious officials comes up to criticize him or to test him or to try to embarrass him or challenge him. And that's been the pattern in Mark. And so the reader kind of braces here for a conflict. It says, one of the synagogue officials named Jairus came up and on seeing him, fell at his feet. Whoa. That's a surprise. He comes to Jesus and he falls down at his feet right there in front of everybody, which would have been political suicide. You know, it would have been really bad for his reputation. Remember how Nicodemus came at night to speak to Jesus? This guy comes right out and falls down at Jesus' feet. Why? Because, as we're about to read, Jairus is a desperate man. He has a daughter. He has one child, a daughter, who is sick, and sick to the point of death. Jairus lived in a time when 60% of kids who were born did not survive to adulthood. And so when kids got sick, they often died. His daughter is 12 years old. So here's this one child he's had, he's poured his whole life into. who is now right on the cusp of becoming a woman, of being a, of you know, she made it, and now she's sick, and he's seen enough kids die to know. And so Jairus is a desperate man. He comes and he falls down at Jesus' feet, and it says that he implored him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Please come and lay your hands on her so that she will get well and live." He's begging, is what those words mean. My only daughter is dying, but I believe that if you come, she will live. That's the scene. And Jesus went off with him. And the large crowd was following him and pressing in on him. So Jesus sees this man and he's like, "Let's go." And the crowd is like, "Ha, it's on, let's go. He's gonna do something." And so off they go. You just picture this huge crowd, you know, Jesus like making his way, and off they go to Jairus' house. Verse 25, a woman who had had a hemorrhage for 12 years and had endured much at the hands of many physicians and had spent all that she had was not helped at all, but rather had grown worse. After hearing about Jesus, she came up in the crowd. So now we have a totally different character. Mark sort of abruptly in the middle of the story introduces a totally different person who couldn't be more different from Jairus. He says, also in the crowd is this woman. And she has a chronic medical condition. It says a woman who had had a hemorrhage for 12 years. This is referring probably to a uterine disease where her bleeding is not controlled, does not stop, probably ever. And remember, she lives in a time where there's not modern conveniences for things like that. This is actually a major problem in the third world today, still. This condition is devastating because of its impact on daily life. And look at this description. Look how much ink Mark spends. He wants us to really understand her situation, how much she's suffering. He spends more time describing her suffering than Jairus' daughter on her deathbed. He wants to impress upon us, look at this. She would be experiencing physical pain, probably. Many different side effects that could come from this, including things like anemia. She would, and look how he describes. He says that she had endured much at the hands of many physicians. So over these years, she sought different, you know, people to help with this. And he says that but all that it's caused is pain. She's had to endure. I actually went back and read, because you can look up medical knowledge from different times in history. And in first century ancient Near East, their remedies for this exact condition are barbaric. You know, it's horrible. And they have no modern medical knowledge. So just imagine, God only knows what she endured at the hands of these physicians. And worse than that, they didn't work at all. They're totally superstitious. You know, like one of them, I'll share a couple that aren't that bad. One of them I read, you get this special kind of onion, you mix it with wine, you ferment that. She drinks it, and then you command her, cease your discharge. That's one. One of them is that you sneak up on her and startle her. Cease your discharge. I'm not making this up. So she has endured much at the hands of many physicians. It says she spent all she had. So she has physical pain. She has financial pain because this cleaned her out. She spent every penny trying to right this problem, which is literally ruining her life. And probably, honestly, in this time in history, in this place in the world, she probably was divorced by her husband at this point, and she probably was homeless. If she's penniless, she probably is utterly destitute because of this. And all of it, he says, was not helped at all, but rather had grown worse. I mean, have you ever had the frustration of like a medical problem that you can't really ever understand or resolve? Just imagine it. And maybe worst of all would be the social pain that would come from this. Living in first century ancient Near East, there would be isolation and humiliation and embarrassment and even shame over this. Isolation because Levitical law says that she would be ritually unclean. You know, in the Old Testament, there's this designation, clean or unclean. And there's a few different reasons for that, but one of them was just sort of like, you know, 4,000-year-old public health, where if you had anything that had to do with communicable disease, there was kind of a primitive quarantine. You know, so if you had come in contact with a dead body of a person or an animal, you know, if you were a mule skinner, okay, if you had mold in your home, if you were bleeding, or if you had any kind of emission from your body, male or female, you were unclean. And that meant you had to stay away from other people for a certain period of time. But the problem is that this has been going on for 12 years. So understand that in her culture, that would make her like a permanent societal outcast. And everybody knows why. So there's humiliation with that. And of course, the rabbinic tradition had over the centuries added layers that added like a stigma, a negativity to this. In their culture, they believed that if you were sick, it was because you'd fallen out of favor with God. So if you had some kind of ailment, you know, they see Bob Zimmerman over here with his elbow in a brace, they're going to be like, you know, what'd you do? Right? Like, you must have made God mad. You're cursed. Now, that's not biblical, and Jesus battled against that, including in this passage, but that was the thinking of the time. So think of how people looked at her. They also, another rule with cleanliness is that if you were unclean, you couldn't be around others, or you would make them unclean by touching the same surfaces or being in the same space with them. So this would be a very lonely, very sad, very painful way of life. She is the opposite of Jairus. Jairus is a man with well standing. Everyone knows his name. He's got means. A man of high reputation that he's willing to spend to get access to Jesus. But she is, you know, women couldn't even speak to men in public back then. Especially not an unclean woman. Especially not to the rabbi. It's interesting that she is not even named in our passage. Jairus' name, she is nameless, hopeless, desperate case who does not have access to Jesus. But they do have two really important things in common. One is they both have a desperate situation. And two is they both believe that Jesus can do something about it. So it says, after hearing about Jesus, she came up in the crowd behind him and touched his cloak. For she thought, if I just touch his garments, I'll get well. So this is her thinking. If I can touch him, even just his clothing, that would make me well. Which is really a superstitious way of thinking, you know? Like Jesus is a battery with power in his clothes, and if I touch it, I can just get it, you know, I could glean a little spiritual power. It's not really how it works. Jesus healed willfully, volitionally. But this is her thinking. This is a bold and reckless and desperate plan. And she does it. She came up in the crowd and she touched his cloak. And it worked. Immediately, the flow of her blood was dried up. And she felt in her body that she was healed of her affliction. So she knows the minute she touches him, something was different. She can sense in her body something has been healed. This plan, crazy as it was, worked. And just imagine, you know, I did it. I pulled it off. Like her life can literally turn around from this point. Praise God. That's how powerful Jesus' clothing is. And then she hears the words that she really did not want to hear. Immediately, Jesus, perceiving in himself that the power proceeding from him had gone forth, turned around in the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" Who did that? Stop. Someone touched me. Who was it? Think about the mortification, okay? When I was in college, they hired this big-time professor who was pretty famous in his field. They were trying to build this whole department around him, and they had spent big bucks to bring him in. Well-known. You could Google him if I told you who he was. This guy came in, and we were all nervous. Like, you know, are we going to actually meet this person face-to-face? And so I remember it was intimidating the day that he walked into the classroom and everyone's like, there's the dude. That's him. And, you know, he greeted the class and he went up and he began writing something on the board. And I was nervously fidgeting with my pen, which I had unscrewed. And I was kind of pushing the core of it on the spring. And I still do not know how this happened, but it got loose. And it was like slow motion, you know, it was like, right in front of my face, end over end, in his direction, and then smack, hits the chalkboard right next to him. And I was like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. You know, I looked down, and the whole class is kind of like, what the heck? And I'll never forget, because he just stopped. He just stopped writing. And then he turned around, and he said, who did that? I just remember my face being like, And so I held my pen and I just put my eyes down, and he stood there for, it was probably 10 seconds, but it felt like, you know, a year and a half. And then he turned back around and resumed class. And I'll never forget that feeling. But this is Jesus, okay? She is in this, she shouldn't even be in this crowd. She's made everyone in this crowd unclean. She made him unclean. She touched the teacher with her hand. And he was like, stop. Who did that? And the disciples said to him, you see the crowd pressing in on you. And you say, who touched me? You know, they're like, dude, you're in a crowd. Everyone is touching you. Like, who isn't touching you would be a better question. So they're just like, how are you going to say, who touched me? But Jesus is like, no, no, no. Look what it says. That he perceived in himself that the power proceeding from him had gone forth. He's like, no, no. Someone touched me believing that they could be healed. The touch of faith, and they have been healed. And who is it? And you can just picture the whole crowd sort of stopping as he stands there, scanning the crowd. And he looked around to see the woman who had done this. Their eyes meet. He knows. She knows. So here's our one-on-one. Jesus and a one-on-one in a crowd. How about that? But the woman, fearing and trembling, aware of what had happened to her, came and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. She just tells her story. And Jesus said to her, what's he going to say? Well, how dare you? You know, who do you think you... You know how presumptuous this was? You've just made me unclean. I'm headed to go. There's a little girl's life hanging in the balance. And you're gonna interrupt me in this crowd. No, he doesn't say any of those things. He says, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your affliction. That's what he says. And I think it's a good opportunity to stop and ask our question, what does this teach us about Jesus? This is teaching us something very important about Jesus. What's it teaching us? Jesus, the man of compassion. I believe that he knew full well what he was doing when he healed this woman. He cared about her. She was discarded by society, and yet he wanted to make this right. Look at how he calls her daughter. That might just seem like he's just being nice to her. I think it's actually a little bit more special than that, because I looked, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I searched and I could not find another single example where Jesus addresses a person as daughter. That's not just something he said. It made me wonder if it was a coincidence that he's off to heal Jairus' daughter, right? It's almost like he's saying how Jairus feels about his daughter is how I feel about you. You're my daughter of 12 years. Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace. Go in shalom. That's like peace with God. He's making sure she knows we are good. You are good. What you did was right, and go in peace. We're square. And be healed of your affliction. He's the healer of hopeless situations. In one of the other translations I was reading, he says, go in peace, your suffering is over. Here's this thing that no physician could remedy, that her life savings couldn't remedy. And he did it with a brush of his cloak. And I think Jesus, who includes outcasts. You know, I was thinking about this. Why does he stop and bust her out like this? You know what I mean? Like, do you think he really didn't know when he said, who touched me? He knew, because then he looked right at her. Right? He knew. When Jesus asks questions, it's not because he's curious for information. It's for our benefit. He decided to make a spectacle of this. You know what he could have done? He could have let her touch him, turned around, given her a smile and a nod, and kept going. He could have made that a discreet mercy to her, which undoubtedly would have been what she would have wanted, and it would be more convenient for him. He could get on with what he was doing. Why didn't he do that? He said, everyone stop, and look, who did this? And look what she did. I think he wanted everyone to see in a bold way his acceptance of her. Here's a woman who did not have access to Jesus socially, and yet he turned that on its head. Everyone, she has access to me. Do you see that? This unclean woman touched me. I'll stand here with her in uncleanness. I will be unclean with her. And she's my daughter. And we have peace. It's amazing. And the other thing I see is that Jesus is a rewarder of faith. You know, that's the thing that he draws attention to in this moment. Of all the things he could have said, what does he point us to? Her faith. He says, your faith has made you well. He publicly praises her for her faith. And that's what theologians or, you know, Bible interpreters, when you read through the Bible, sometimes you look for sentences like this. We call them theme statements, where in a narrative, there's all this stuff and people happening and people saying things. But every once in a while, someone sort of declares a kind of a moral of the story, or it's usually something about God, a truth about the heavenly realms. And here it is in this passage. What's this all about? Jesus says, her faith has made her well. So what does that mean? That Jesus rewards faith. Because we mean different things. You know, if I'm watching the Buckeyes, I might be like, you know, I don't know. It looks like we're down, but I have faith they can come back. It sometimes means like something I hope for or wishful thinking. But the word here in Greek is the word for believe, or sometimes even maybe more accurately, it's to entrust. It's when I entrust myself to something else. And so maybe a good definition is like placing your trust in someone or something to the extent that you are willing to act based on that trust. So this morning, you guys all displayed faith in your chair because you sat in it. You know, you looked at it and you were like, it's probably not going to collapse. Looks sturdy. I've sat in a lot of chairs. I'm willing to put my weight in it and risk falling on the floor, right? That's faith. You had confidence that chair would support your weight. And thankfully it did. But so it's this idea of looking at something and saying, I'm willing to entrust myself to it. When my kids were little, toddlers, you know, and they were constantly falling down and like getting in perilous situations. And a big part of your job as a parent is to rescue them And we used to say, I save my kid's life 10 times a day when they're 2 years old, right? Because they're just like, oh, whoop, they're falling over there, you know? And what they learn from that is that no matter what they do, you're going to, like, they have faith in their parents that they can catch them. And my kids now who are big still have that faith, which is becoming increasingly misplaced. You know what I mean? Like, you know, there'll be four steps up on the stairs and, you know, Tom will be like, hey dad, guess what? Wham! And he'll jump at me and I'm like, oh my God. You know, I'm glad you still have me as an object of your faith. But what is that? It's entrusting yourself to someone else. That's the word that he uses. The key element here is willingness to act. You know, I can look in that chair and say, look sturdy. I believe that it is sturdy. I have confidence in it, but that's different than being like, I'm willing to put my weight on it. The moment that you act in accordance with your belief in something, the moment you put some skin in the game, that's when it becomes faith. Think about Thor when he holds out, you know, in the Avengers, when he has his hammer, which if he calls for it, it will come from wherever it is into his hand, right? He trusts in that hammer enough that he can put his hand out in faith that it will come, and it always does. There's an action component in faith. The key here is that what matters is not the amount or strength of your faith. It is the object of your faith. It's what you're putting your faith in. It's not that she had such an unbelievably strong faith. It's not that she did some amazing thing or that she just believed more than everyone else. It's not that. It's that she touched the right guy. She had a lot of faith in those other physicians. She blew her life savings on other physicians. But what's better? A lot of faith in onions and wine or a little faith in the guy that can actually resolve it? What's better? A lot of faith in a rickety chair or a little faith in a stable chair? I have a sick child at home right now. Not deathly ill, of course, just a fever. And it's not COVID. We tested, okay? But what we do sometimes is I get out my stuffed animal from when I was a little boy, dog to doggy. And if you're sick at my house, then dog to doggy, you get dog to doggy for the night to help you. And they love that. And so I go up and I'm like, hey, you know, you've got to wake him up in the night. You got a fever. It's time to take some Motrin. And they're like, I don't want to take Motrin. I'm like, come on. You know, you got to take it. And they're like, I don't need it. I've got dog to doggy. So what's better? A lot of faith in dog to doggy, who is a 30-year-old sack of beans. It's probably 50% comprised of dust mites by this point. Or a little faith in ibuprofen. It's about what you put your faith in. And that's important because you put faith in stuff every day. You put faith in other people. You put faith in organizations. You put faith in technology. We put faith all over the place. Jesus is saying, what's important is that you put some chips down on me. God is delighted when we place our trust in him. That's why he busts her out in this exemplary way. Look what she did. She trusted in me. Just like I'm happy when my kids choose to trust in ibuprofen, because I know it will help them. God is delighted when we place our trust in him. And so Jesus, I think, made this into a teachable moment. He says, everyone stop and look at this woman's exemplary faith. And what does he want us to get? I am powerful. I am compassionate. I do care about your suffering, and I don't care about your uncleanness. I have become to begin to set things right, and I can, and what I need from you is a little faith. It's an amazing lesson. But this whole time we left Jairus hanging. I don't know if you guys thought about that. Verse 35, while Jesus was still speaking, they came from the house of the synagogue official saying, your daughter has died. Why trouble the teacher anymore? Oh my gosh, this is such a painful story. This is so tragic. He stops to have this beautiful moment, and meanwhile, she dies. She dies. Jairus has come all, he's given everything, he's got Jesus coming, and she dies. And just think about what the woman would have been feeling as she hears that. She's elated. She's been held up and praised by God, and she's also caused the death of a 12-year-old girl. And what do you think Jairus is feeling? Besides being, numb with grief, I'm sure, just think about the rage. This woman caused this. He was coming to save her. You interrupted him. You distracted him. You used his power and his time, and now my daughter is dead. This is a horrible situation. And the people, the messengers are like, don't bother. Why trouble the teacher? She's gone. Missed your chance. But Jesus, overhearing what was being spoken, said to the synagogue official, do not be afraid any longer. Only believe. It's so interesting. Jesus doesn't tell him any, he doesn't say he's going to do anything. He just looks at Jairus and he's like, faith. You should have faith in me. Honestly, it's a pretty hard pill to swallow, you know? He already had faith in him, but this is totally different. You know, why should I have faith? And there's an important lesson there that if we're placing our faith in a stable object like Jesus Christ, then we should have faith in him even if we can't see exactly what he's going to do. Well, it says, Jesus allowed no one to accompany him except Peter and James and John and the brother of James, and they came to the house of the synagogue official. So Jesus is like, you should believe in me. Let's go. And they go anyway. And he saw a commotion and people loudly weeping and wailing. First century funerals in this part of the world were a total affair. They would bring in musicians. You would have sometimes they would even hire mourners to come and lead the mourning with like chants. They would have hand clapping and music. This was the way of getting the word out. Someone died. And so basically Jesus gets there and she's dead and gone and the funeral's in full swing. And entering in, he said to them, to the mourners, why make a commotion and weep? The child has not died, but is asleep. Which is a very weird thing to say, because she was indeed dead. And other accounts that we have of the same event make that crystal clear. Why does he say that? And they begin laughing at him. They're just like, how would you react if someone showed up to a funeral and like, they're not dead, you know? But putting them all out, he took along the child's father and mother and his own companions, and he entered the room where the child was. Taking the child by the hand, touching a dead body, he said to her, Talitha kum, which translated means, little girl, I say to you, get up. And immediately the girl got up and began to walk, for she was 12 years old, and immediately they were completely astounded. Talitha kum. You're like, what is that? Is that a spell? No, that is Aramaic. That's just Peter saying, I remember the exact words he said. He said, little girl, get up. And she got up. So what do we see here about Jesus? Well, that his power is absolutely adequate. And I like how the passage kind of casts doubt on it. Did you notice earlier when it was like, when the woman touched him, it said that the power emanating from him went forth. Can you think of anywhere else in Scripture where it describes God's power like that, as like a commodity that could be expended? It kind of brings into mind like, you know, does Jesus have a magic meter, you know, and now it's depleted? Did he rev up one heel and then she stole it? And now he doesn't have anything less. And so what you see, though, is that, no, not only is Jesus not at all limited by what he did, the stakes are actually much higher. You know, Jairus had faith that Jesus had the power to heal a sick girl. But instead, Jesus does something much more dramatic by reviving someone from the dead after using his power elsewhere. And so this is Jesus's way of, Jesus was not fazed. Jesus' tank wasn't empty, even though the task went from hard to impossible. Jesus gave them strict orders that no one should know about this, and he said that something should be given her to eat. He's like, don't tell anyone about this. Get her up. Get her a Pop-Tart. And she's good to go. Why the secrecy? There's a lot of secrecy. He only takes the, you know, James and John and Peter with him. He only, he tells them not to tell anyone. The reason is because it's pretty early in Jesus' ministry. And it's just not his time yet. Later, when he does this more publicly with Lazarus, it leads immediately to his crucifixion. And it also leads Lazarus to get grief. So he knows if everyone understands what happened here, it's going to hasten Jesus' death, and it's not time for that. And it also is going to probably bring a lot of pressure down on this family. And so I think that's why he said to them when he got there, and he's like, she's not dead, she's just asleep. I think he's giving some plausible deniability about what happened there. And they laughed because they're like, don't be ridiculous. We're positive she's dead. Later on, Christians, you know, he's not really lying either, because he knows that in one manner of speaking, she was only asleep in the sense that she would be returning. All right, well, let's conclude this. What does it teach us about Jesus? Well, we've seen a lot that it teaches us about Jesus, his compassion, his power, his inclusion of marginalized people, and his love for them. I think one thing I'd like to add, though, is that he can and will set hopeless and broken things right. You know, one of the themes through this passage is Jesus sort of overcoming the tragedies that are common to all of us. We're all afflicted with the same things, with failing bodies, and with the grief of the fact that people die, including ourselves. And that's one of the things that's happening through this section in Mark, is that Jesus is demonstrating his willingness and power to overcome a lot of the symptoms of our alienation from God. The human race is alienated from God, and therefore nature doesn't work right, and we're subject to the evil power of demonic forces, and we get sick, and we die. And in this section in Mark, what does he do? He calms the storm. He casts out demons. He heals the sick, and he revives the dead. It's amazing. He's demonstrating, this is what my kingdom is going to be like. And someday it will be fully consummated, and therefore you can have hope that even when you die in this life, that someday Jesus is going to say to you, open your eyes and get up. And the Bible promises that when he returns, that he's going to wipe away every tear, and that death itself already has been conquered by Jesus Christ on the cross and will once for all be erased. And so what that means is that as Christians, we can face the tragedy. I mean, our world is tragic. Every single day, it's tragic. And yet we can look on that with hope in the future, and in the meantime, faith that we can count on him. What's it teach us about salvation? Does it teach us anything about salvation? It does, even though that isn't what Jesus really necessarily puts in view, although he does say your faith has saved you, is actually the word there. But I think that it does, because these things that he's battling, sickness and death, they are symptoms of our alienation from God. And what Jesus said is that his ultimate mission wasn't just to improve lives. His ultimate mission was to reconcile all of human race with God, to erase these problems completely. And do you know how you get made right with God? How do you get reconciled with God? It's faith. It's the identical mechanism as to what both Jairus and the woman had. Even a tiny amount of low quality faith. Faith in him to pay your way on the cross, so that you can be right with God. And many times when Jesus heals people, he does apply it in exactly that way. This is a picture of how one actually gets saved and made right with God. What does it teach us about ourselves? Well, I think it teaches us that all of us face hopeless and desperate situations. And if you can't yet relate with one of these people, you will. In this life, we all will. And that when that happens, when we face that cliff that I just can't look off, when we have that problem that I just cannot resolve, Jesus' invitation is, you know, put your faith in a lot of things, but make sure to save a little bit for me, because I'm the one who can do something about it. Why don't you invite me into your life? Why don't you try me and see what I got? That's Jesus' invitation. That's the story of the woman in the crowd. God, thanks for this. I just felt so grateful studying this passage this week and how human it is and how very real it is. Thank you that you came. You didn't like send us some wild message, you know, write a message on the moon or come in some distant way, but you came in the form of a person to interact with us as a person and show us who you are as a person. And I'm grateful for that. Help us to have faith in you, because, boy, I want to put my faith in all kinds of other things. And this life is brutal. We get battered in this life. But thank you for the reminder that all we need is a little bit of energy to reach out toward you, and that you are thrilled when we do that. And I pray for anyone here today who is suffering and who is in a hopeless situation, that you would help them reach out to you, and that you would let them know your joy in that step of faith. Amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.